I've been away for 3 months, and I appreciate not teaching, and I appreciate teaching. So it's nice to be back, but it was also nice to have the time away. And the phase retirement, I think, is going quite well for myself. Although, when people ask me what I'm doing, I have very little to say in response to that. I like to keep it unknown. So I'm just, no, I don't have a day planned, and that feels like a retirement to me. But I will be teaching this month, and then August and September. So this month, August and September and December. Those will be the remaining months I have. So what's new here? I have hearing aids for the first time. I can now listen to questions and actually get them right. Not the answer, but the question. So it's nice to be able to hear again. So this evening, I want to continue the series I will and have been doing. It'll continue right on through probably until December, when I'll start wrapping up for those remaining weeks. But looking at a subject of where the practice is going, and then the usual ways that we get caught up in various degrees of difficulty and troublesome activity along that particular continuum. Tonight I want to talk about construction and deconstruction. So, as all of us know, pretty much as soon as we come out of the womb, we're in a stage of construction. The child that is born is very deconstructed. There's not much there. You can feel a free-floating consciousness, but without a lot of functionality, except the genetic functions. And very quickly, the child learns in the course of their months and years to construct themselves around other people's expectations, around their own ideals, around the shoulds and should nots that all of us endure, around other people's judgments and their own judgment as well. And all of this begins to mold their consciousness in a particular way. But inside, that young child, is basically an animal. And I don't mean that in any kind of slight. It's the fact that we're wild inside. We're a wolf or a bear, and it's just the consensus and the conventional reality that sort of tones that down and chisels and shapes that child into what the society wants the child to be. But inside, there's a wildness there, something that's untamed. And as we're being constructed by culture, most of us feel that wildness, do we not? In fact, many of us are afraid of that wildness. We call it, the untamed part of us, and in Freudian terms, it's the id. It's the part that is unpredictable and untamed and is shocking to many folk. And so we keep ourselves muffled. We keep that part of ourselves at bay. And we continue to thrive within the constructions of our life. Meanwhile, we're the whole of the consciousness. That's what it means to be wild. It means we're the whole of the human species. We're not what society has made us only. We remain the entire spectrum of consciousness, meaning that we have all of the different emotions and feelings. We have all of the different expressions of humanity within us. And we're trying to slice it out, carve it out, so that we only display or feel a certain proportion of that. And because conventional reality tells us some are appropriate and some are inappropriate, we then label those particular qualities in ourselves as being helpful or not, skillful or not, depending upon the tribe, the culture, the society we're in. But the point here is that that wildness is not really honored. The range of our consciousness is not honored. We try to tame it, and which puts an enormous amount of pressure on us, does it not? Enormous amount of tension, because it's not as if we get rid of it through our suppression. We just don't see it. We just keep it away from our vision. And we try to seal ourselves off from those things which we don't believe fit the person I'm beginning to believe I am. And what it does, there's a psychic hole that most of us can feel from time to time, a kind of emptiness. I mean, there's a psychological component to it which makes us feel isolated or disconnected or, you know, not appreciated. But really, what's coming forth there, I believe, is that wildness, that untamed wildness that we have been so busy trying to mold, is continuing to express itself. And it feels as if we're out of place somehow, because the very slender thread we have with the conventional reality doesn't keep that other at bay. It comes in and it doesn't seem to fit within the context of what we have learned about ourselves or what we have learned to be. And there's a sense in us that something, again, there can be a psychological component, that there's a hole or an emptiness in us, that something is incomplete and something doesn't feel like I'm able to give expression to, that I'm a work in progress. That's one that most of us feel, that we're sort of pretending to be what we're expected to be. There's a kind of a sense that we're not really living up to the fact of what we're proclaiming ourselves to be. All of those. And then the need to continually inflate ourselves back into what conventional reality wants from us. It's like a leaking tire, because as soon as we don't keep blowing it up, it goes flat, and we go back to that feeling of sort of lamentation, of woe, of just being ourselves, and ourselves just doesn't fit. And so along with that feeling, I've talked about the lack of belonging. That's a very important accompanying part of this sort of deflated self-image. But we don't really spend much time dwelling upon that. We think it's just us. We just think we have a problem, you know, and we just think we need to get over that particular feeling and get on with the life that we see other people living and seemingly doing quite well, and just keeping pushing ourselves forward. And we discover a mindfulness, and mindfulness seems to make it worse, doesn't it? I mean, have you noticed that? When you first start in meditation, it shows us all the things that we've been hiding from, all the qualities of our temperament, all of the areas that don't fit the carving quality of our image. And as we practice mindfulness, we begin to relax more, which is an important quality of mindfulness. And guess what happens? Within that relaxation, the tensions that are buried deeper within us spring forth. So we begin to feel the psychic outbreak of even deeper tensions that we never even knew were there or had long since forgotten, beginning to show and personify and present themselves in imagery, sometimes in dreams. Sometimes we move over into the archetypical the sense of a common consciousness of human beings and the images of all of that. So, you know, mindfulness doesn't seem to solve the problem. In fact, it's for someone who is looking for an easy, relaxed persona, mindfulness isn't offering that. It doesn't initially offer us a place where we can feel more at home with ourselves. It offers us the drama of our fears, really. And as I mentioned, this wildness in us, this untamed quality, also holds qualities that we deeply fear in us. The rage, the unmitigated anger, lust, you know, all of that, those qualities get you in prison. And so we are very reluctant to take mindfulness on the way it's being described. Now, this is an important point, because the real training here is not that the presentation is going to go away or is even going to alter. It's learning how to live with self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is seeing these things which we have long since pushed away or denied, projected onto others, beginning to take accountability for all these different qualities, and being able to live with it, to live with that. That's the real challenge of being conscious. And most of us didn't get into it for that. We got into it to sort of be the love we hear about, the metta, you know, the smiling deva, the angelic person that we think spirituality will allow us to become. And so we don't really know why we're doing what we're doing, especially when these forces begin to intervene. The other thing that I find students are very hesitant to share what it is that's coming up at this particular phase of practice, because they're ashamed of it. They think they're the only ones that are feeling these tempestuous emotions, and they don't want the teacher or even their peers to know that that's arising in them. And so they push it down. And this sense of construction, this is a very important time right now that I'm talking about, because as these things are coming up, what the instructions are is to see them, right? What does that do? How does that help? Like, it's like, just sit down and see it, you know, and we're not, that's not the way we've been trained. We haven't been trained just to sit back and watch something. We've been trained to take action against. And when we take action against, we're reconstructing our lives in accordance to the patterns and the idealisms that we have, that has been motivating us from the beginning. And so we question this, and here's another hesitation with students, is that in general, they won't really question the seeing to the extent that's necessary. They just assume it, but inside they aren't doing it. They just aren't going to show that they're not doing it. Inside we're fighting, we're tense, we are combating what it is that's arising, and somehow seeing is supposed to be helpful, and we don't have any idea why that would be helpful. But instead of exploring that or questioning that or really uncovering the value of seeing, we distort the scene so that we're actually doing something within the scene. We're constructing ourselves. And so much of mindfulness early on is an attempt to alter the arising of forces that we just now discovered within us. And what we think we're going to do, and the best way to handle this problem, is to start covering them with layers of construction. So we look for ways to beautify ourselves within the mindfulness, within the spiritual journey. And love is certainly one of the ones that feel most compelling, because it feels like the antithesis of what we're feeling inside. Give me some breathing space here, let me have some love. So we head to that, not as an intention to really find love, but as an intention to offset the forces that we want, that are coming forth in our consciousness. And so we're trying to construct new layers upon those forces to seal them off, now with spiritual values, with spiritual intentions. But the problem is that when that doesn't work, and it's a key moment when you learn that it cannot and does not work, key moment, and the key is that you no longer rely upon construction for your salvation. You no longer rely upon adding something to yourself as a way to keep you from the fears of the states of mind that you sense are still in there, the wildness that's still in there in you. And that moment of recognition that construction does not work is a key moment. I can't think of another word, but it's better than key moment. Because everything changes from then, you see. And you're still playing with seeing, but seeing really isn't being held with the validity that the instructions are giving it. Again, what good is it? You know, I've had so many doubts throughout my years. Say, what good is this? You know, I should be doing something about this. And it wasn't until I was honest enough to have that communication with a teacher that I was really I was able to be shown or encouraged to see the value of the instructions, as opposed to what I felt the instructions were not doing for me. And so this is the tension. If the seeing doesn't construct, the doing constructs. But if I see that the construction doesn't work in keeping those feelings at bay, because I'm getting conscious, you know, all this time I'm practicing awareness, consciousness is becoming more accessible. And so I'm more aware of things that are arising within me, and I see that when I place any tension upon a state of mind, that state of mind becomes embellished. It doesn't become depleted. And any time I react or resist, I'm conscious enough now to know I'm no longer blind to the effects that tension has upon that which I am aversive of, that it grows and becomes more problematic through the tensions that I assert. And so, how do I keep my guard up? How do I keep the demons at bay? Plus, I'm sensing deeper and wilder issues within me, right? Pre-socialization issues, you know, the human animal issues, right? So you begin to get a sense then that trying to offset the states of mind is not going to be very helpful. Now, the deep lessons of Dharma often come unexpectedly. And the unexpected issue that begins to arise along this particular trail, continuum, is that when something appears, I put my fists up and guard against it. And the object of that is to have it disappear. And that's the tension that most of us have lived with our whole life. We don't want something to appear. If it's appear, it becomes real, and I have to take actions against it, and I am then consumed within the tensions I have with it. That's the appearance. It can be appearance of anything. It can be appearance of a disturbing neighbor, or it can be appearance of something inside of us that is an emotion that we're having, or a thought, or a storyline, or an emotional expression, memory, anything. So this sense of being guarded to keep appearances at bay has been sort of our main objective. And if we're tricky enough, we can often, and blind enough, and unconscious enough, we can keep that state of mind at bay enough so that it disappears from consciousness, so that I'm not aware that it's there. We've just pushed it behind ourselves and pretended it's not there, but that's good enough. So this sense of appearance or disappearance is really the key issue that has been driving our tension-filled lives up until this point. Now we have to switch. We switch metaphors. Instead of appearance and disappearance, it becomes whether we're guarded or unguarded. And let me explain that. You see, what we begin to learn is that we cannot control what it is that the mind is doing. Is whatever is arising, we have no control over it. We're at the expense of what's arising. It's arising, and we have to deal with what's arising. If we try to keep things from arising, that's the appearance and disappearance model, and that's where the tension-filled existence within ourselves lies. All right, so knowing that the full of consciousness, the wild side of ourselves, the tension-bearing parts of ourselves that are unappreciated by culture at large, and the ideal that we set to match and to be counter to that, to those appearances, that those ideals that we think about are the way we should be, all of that has led to the kind of life that has made us miserable. So now we have to reorganize ourselves sufficiently to realize that we are not in control of appearances. What comes in to us is not up to us. It's not under our control. And as soon as we try to apply control, we apply tension, and we embellish that state of mind that we're trying to get rid of, and it actually grows in strength. So it doesn't work to try to control the display of consciousness. That's a huge lesson. And I'd just like to pause from time to time to express these are radically changed, radical alternatives to the way that the majority of the population lives. When we realize we are no longer in control of the display of consciousness, then we begin to understand, or we have an inroad into why seeing is important. Right? Before, we didn't want to see. We didn't want to see because disappearance and appearance was the polarity that we were playing against. Why would I want to see more? And what's seeing going to do this? Seeing just keeps me looking at it. Keeps it in appearance. I don't want it to be in appearance. You see? So then, in the changing depth of our understanding, sometimes this takes, we're talking about years, to get to the point where we can actually, okay, so the appearance and disappearance is not where I'm going to force the issue. So now we have a different relationship to everything. When things arise, we hear the instruction to see. Okay, seeing, what does seeing do? Well, seeing doesn't place any pressure on the appearance to disappear, does it? If it disappears on its own, fine. But that's not where we're going with this. So there's no tension, there's no need to turn away from. And things do show themselves, and they do automatically and in their own time disappear. So there is the play of that going on within consciousness. But what appears is also not under our control. What we can do that is under our control is to whether we'll be guarded or unguarded in relationship to the appearance that is arising. Now, why is that important? Stay with me on this because it gets very interesting. If we are guarded when something arises, then we're going to make that into an enemy. We don't have a defense mechanism against something we feel safe within. We get guarded, defended, when something threatens us. And now we have a section of our mind that we feel guarded against because we have learned through our socialization that this particular aspect of ourselves is not, if you're a good person, you won't have this particular quality. You'll have other good qualities, but you won't have this awful quality, these wild qualities, these id-related qualities. And yet they're coming up. And we see ourselves being guarded in relationship to them. And it's not working to stay guarded. And so we're supposed to see them. So what if I see them unguarded? Because guarded's not working. See, if it's not working, don't wait for the teacher 20 years later to say, okay, guardedness doesn't work. Oh, you discover that. Each of us discover that on our own. So what does unguardedness look like? Okay, so this is where it gets interesting. When we're unguarded to something, guess what happens? We see it clearly. Because when we're guarded, we're building a story about how fearful of an enemy or the tensions that we need to have and to keep this at bay. The story consumes us, but not the seeing. We could care less about what we see. We're immersed in the story of it. When we're unguarded, to be unguarded, we can't meet whatever is arising with a story. If you meet it with a story, you won't be unguarded, you'll be guarded. So as we begin to allow things to arise within us unguarded, we begin to actually see what it is that's arising, that's not story-driven, true seeing. And we go, oh, wait a minute, I heard that in an instruction about 15 years ago, that we're supposed to be with things as they are, just see them. Oh, this makes sense to me now. You see, here's something else about being unguarded. This is key. Remember, at the beginning of this talk, I was talking about how we embellish love. All of us are kind of, or many of us are on the love train of Vipassana because we think it can make our heart grow and all of that sort of thing. And many of us are very frustrated by our inability or incapacity to sustain that love because we have been so guarded in our life, and guardedness assures us that love will not be able to penetrate at all into our life When we're guarded against love. That's basically what we're guarded against. In order to feel life in its true form, you have to be connected to it. As you're guarded against it, you put a shield up, you're not going to feel life touch you, and therefore there will be no love. But when we're unguarded, that is, when we're willing just to see, now through the seeing comes the unguardedness. Are people following this? Okay. Through the seeing comes the unguardedness. Through the unguardedness comes the love. Said differently, the seeing is love. So now I can see, and I'm not going, without any aversion, without any sense of protection, suddenly the way that sight, the seeing happens is that it's in love. It's within love. The seeing is within love. In other words, you see differently. You don't see, if you see from a story, that's still guardedness. You're seeing from the quietness of just the seeing, and the seeing from that depth of quietness is love. Now, in unguarded seeing, there's true caring. All along the way, I have been deconstructing myself, not constructing myself. And we're so in the, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times people say, what is this anatta stuff? You know, I don't understand selflessness. Just do it, and selflessness will land in your lap. And this is how it lands in your lap. As we begin just to see, it's the story that we construct ourselves with. We are the story that constructs ourselves and keeps us from seeing. So if we just see, the basic instruction was the way in to deconstruction, the anatta, the emptiness of self, love, and unguardedness. Isn't that beautiful? I just thought sometimes you just, I'm not saying my words are beautiful. It's the way this thing moves. So the treasures, the preciousness of where it lands, you see, you go, oh God, just seeing. Oh, now all of a sudden I understand what this is all about. But I'm not stopped, we're not finished. I'm going to move you even further, even deeper, even into more rich territory. But first I want to stand on this vista and just appreciate the view. Because it's beautiful. Of course, seeing. At first I was scared of seeing. What good is it? You know, that's me. That's me and my story, and that's all the need for to protect myself from the appearance that's there, and that's the appearance and the disappearance and wanting it to disappear. And when I'm in that relationship, that polarity of appearance and disappearance, seeing is useless. Useless. But not when I'm within the guarded and the unguarded. Not when I use that as the system by which I am now moving towards something. Because that's also true of the construction and deconstruction. I'm just using different frames of reference here, saying the same thing. The seeing, there's no construction. There's no self-construction in seeing. That's what's so amazing, is that seeing happens without us. We come in into the scene and add our story about what we see. That's where we come in. But just the seeing doesn't hold that. And suddenly when you're on to seeing, you begin to sense that there's an allure here that can take us very deep, very far, very far. very far. So now it gets more subtle. I'm going to start using the seeing, not for seeing the appearances, because seeing the appearances is just seeing, is more storyline, basically, and it's more self-construction. But what about just the seeing itself? What about just seeing? Now, here's something interesting. Okay, I'm just going to bring it in. If you don't get it, it's fine. Don't stew. Just say, oh, you know, maybe this will come at some point. But I like to stretch you a little bit. Seeing. We began to realize that everything that we see as an appearance is really what we remember something to be. It's the past being coded, the memories, the recognition and memories of what has been, right? And so we're really looking, our seeing is seeing the past. It's seeing what has been because it's an appearance that we know from the past. That's true in everything internally and externally. When we see, we're seeing from the past. It's a little bit like looking up at a starry night and seeing a star and thinking you're seeing it in present time. You're not seeing it in present time. You're seeing it as it was millions of years ago. It looks like it's in present tense, but actually that light came from the star, initiated its direction towards us, depending upon how far the star is from us, perhaps millions and millions of years ago. We're not seeing in present. We're seeing what that star looked like 10 million years ago. So too, when we look out upon all of this, you'll notice that there's a slight hesitation, a slight commentary about what we see, which just distances us a little bit in time so that the seer and the seeing, there's a distance and a contemplation that comes in there. Because the seeing happened. It was, you were identified as somebody that I knew once, or you look like somebody I knew once. This commentary comes in that explains all of that and the memories associated with that. And then there's the appearance and my reactions to all of that. And that's seeing from the past. Right? And if you look around, whenever you recognize something, there's a slight pause between the commentary, the recognition, the commentary that's laced to that recognition, and the time element in the scene. Just, that's why you feel as if you're back away from life. You're not inside of life. You're having the observing, you're objectively observing life. Right? That's the commentary. That objectivity, that distance is the commentary. But the seeing doesn't have the hold, doesn't hold the commentary. The mind holds the commentary. The seeing is immediate. And if I want to cross and step over the commentary, I can't do it through more commentary. I can't argue myself out of my story. I can't talk myself out of thinking. I have to see my way out of thinking. Because seeing sees thinking. So seeing is immediate. Seeing is the present. Everything else is the past. Now, if everything is the past and seeing is the present, which one are you going to go towards? I would suggest the present. Which means that we release the past. That if you have something that's extra and a burden and you can't keep it from arising, which you can't, but you realize that the seeing is seeing, and that's where the real source of life is in the seeing, then you see what you see, but you release it immediately after you've seen it. You don't carry it on more. You don't say, wow, that person, they did that to me again. Now, next time I say, see, that's like living the past even without the appearance. So now, as we get more sophisticated in our seeing, we're more willing to release the past as the past within that seeing. And only the seeing matters. Because only the seeing is current. Only the seeing is present. Present moment. Everything else has the tug of history on it. The tug of recognition, of identification, of remembrance, of my life, my story, my emotional story. But the seeing carries none of that. It hears all of that. It sees the thought. It hears the emotion. But it itself is not tied to the past. It is not derived from the past. It's present moment, always, totally, forever, it is present. So now, we have to deconstruct ourselves yet again. Because everything in life now has been built around the story of my life rather than the seeing of that story. But as I become more refined and more nuanced in my meditation, I begin to recognize the difference between the immediacy of seeing and the distance of the past. One holds life, the other holds suffering. Because as soon as we bring the past in, as if it were the present, we will be tied to the continual history of our lives forever. And the tragedies that that inevitably brings. But if we're willing just to see, it's not that hard. It's the simplest thing. See, this has never been hard. We make it hard because we don't want to see. We want to live the experience and figure our way out of it. But the only way out of it is to switch to the seeing. That's it. There's no other recourse. And everything becomes immediate. And maybe it's so for all of us. Can we sit for a minute or two? Now as we sit, the seeing isn't from the eyes. That's one expression of seeing. But awareness doesn't locate itself within any of the senses only. It works through the senses. And you can also feel the sense or sense the awareness that is free of any of the senses. Okay. I can't remember what I usually do. Do I do question and answers? Do I? Or do we go right into announcements? We don't go into, we do, okay, so if there are any questions. Can you imagine if I took a 5-year gap? Hearing aids are just the first step. Yes, yes, dear. Yes, no, yeah.
So this is more of a comment about the construction thing.
Sure.
So when I was in college, I took this women's theory class, feminism, and that was the first time I'd ever heard we're all social constructs. And that was, of course, from the perspective of women, we ask to do things because we have been in a society that has had all these expectations. And so I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. So I've been, I used that term throughout my life really as a against men, and which is kind of funny, right? Because I was thinking, oh, you know, this is so, I'm so whatever.
Right.
I have this.
Right.
And then last fall, I was here, you talked about how polarization is just a problem, but even being a Buddhist in the country,
yeah. Yes.
Putting up all of these walls.
And yes.
I realized that men were social constructs too.
Sure. That's right.
No,
no, we're all victims here. You know, everybody is a victim of what people have told us we were. And some of us are more victimized by what we've been told. That's really the source of all of our prejudice. But from seeing, that's why the liberation is in the seeing. Liberation from everything, from prejudice, from everything. I mean, it's... Right now, the tensions of the culture are coming, rightly so, into the different expressions of diversity, and because that needs to happen. But the freedom from any prejudice is in the seeing. If we're not careful, the windshield wiper goes to the left and then it goes to the right. It just keeps swinging back and forth because the way we approach prejudice from a mental application is in terms of reactivity, condemnation, judgment, which swings it back the other way. And so we just have to be very careful here that we get this thing right so that we can actually be free of the very things that we are focused upon as being the discriminating issues. Seeing is the answer. Everything else is something we've learned. We've learned it. What we've learned, we can unlearn, we can extinguish. And we haven't been told truthfully what anything is because everybody that taught us believed what the appearances of things, believed in the appearances, not in the seeing, believed in the appearances. And when you communicate appearances to your children, they learn the prejudice of those appearances. That's how it happens. That's what's passed on for us. How many of us have learned how to see? Not very many. But that's what spiritual journey is. It's the journey of seeing. Yes. Okay, so let me get, it's a very good question. Okay, so when you're feeling the resistance, you'll notice that kind of all the arrows go into feeling the resistance. It's like your seeing is from your skin inward, right? It's like, what am I supposed to do now? I'm supposed to see? Okay, so that's a limited expression of seeing. So I would ask that a question. What is it that's seeing the aversion, the resistance? I'm resisting. I'm resisting this. I don't like it. There's no way that I can talk myself out and make this okay. I can't do it. I'm stuck in it. What is it that is seeing the resistance but itself is not resisting? See, just give yourself a question that throws you off scale. Is there something that sees the resistance but itself is not resisting? Is there something? Okay, I don't know. I'm going to see. And you get a sense that there is. It's bigger. It's not inside looking like. It's more, most people feel it as more of a field of awareness. But it sees what is being the resistance, but it's just seeing it. It's not, there's no commentary, nothing. You get it? You sense it? There you go. Go in that direction. Don't go in the perturbed irritability of the resistance that you're having, because that never ends. It just gets more subtle, and it just fries you. Your practice will just be stationary. So you go, okay, so. And that's the way you do with all the hindrances. Okay, I'm sleepy, but is there something? What isn't sleepy in this moment? What knows that sleepiness is? I'm sleepy. But what is there in this moment that isn't sleepy? Yeah. See, there's a purity there. It's not even coming from me. It's like, whoa, it sees it. And now I can go back in and whine about it, and then all my arrows go back in this way, or I can see it and all my arrows go out the other way, you see? Mostly, we're in this. We're trying to struggle in here, and it doesn't. It's just brain on brain. It's mind, you know. It's just. So this is just. Right. So whatever, I'm irritable. What is it that knows that? I'm irritable. Yeah, I give you that. But what is it that knows that? See, reframe the whole issue immediately. That's pure seeing. I hope I'm not losing you. Yes.
Then you're saying that after you can kind of do pure seeing after you've grown up, then you have access to reality. Is there something there that makes us grow up into being able to see that?
Well, yeah, yes. First of all, you should not try to keep your child from conventional reality, because he'd have like a wolf child or something. You know? Just let them grow up as they grow up. And then inside of us, that sense of that animal sense, you know, that we're afraid of, the idishness in us, actually is very beautiful, because it's not the ferocity we think. It's actually the emptiness that we are. And that emptiness is not banal, is not passive. It's expressive. It spontaneity, creativity, all comes from that sense of emptiness. And that begins to drive our journey out of the conventionality, out of the conditioning that's kept us bound. But that's also individually, the readiness for that is individually determined. So if your child doesn't go that direction, then that's just not the way it's going to go. But some of us, a few, a very slim minority, start moving in the direction of wanting to know what it was like before all this got placed on top of us. You know, it doesn't mean that we would become dysfunctional or we don't know how to move in the world. All that still is there. It's just now it's being seen. And so I can still do it, but it's being seen. That's the difference. Before it was being denied, or as being rejected, or being aversive, or being projected, all of that. So now it's just being seen. So all of life continues just as it has been with all of its functionality. And if I had never learned that, I'd be a dullard. You know, I wouldn't know how to get out. You know, I wouldn't know anything. So it's necessary for that to be there. At the same time, so is the seeing that has been neglected. That has to be there too. And you can't train that to somebody who's not ready to be trained. So for parents who say, okay, how do I teach them to see? They have to be ready for that. That's just, it just comes. If you don't believe in incarnation, it's kind of hard to believe that this may go on for a while. I don't know how many of you saw 60 Minutes last week, but they had this 12-year-old master jazz pianist who played at like the great festivals of jazz music, and there's just no any, like he learned it in 1 year. He had no teachers. He just listened to records. And you go, how much proof do we need that, I mean, me who can't play chopsticks? Yes. It's not bad or wrong, so don't, let's take that off the thing. But as you begin to sense the limitation of that skillful means, there's value to it, no question, right? But there's also a limitation to it because it creates a kind of tension around that particular quality. And at some point, the limitation surmounts the value. And at that point, you want to see what is there rather than to put a new layer on top and dismiss it, you see. But that'll come at your own time. Again, it's readiness. And at some point, you just say, you know, this has only gotten me so far. Again, it's a very important step because it makes you a kinder, nicer person. Character is a very important development in the maturity of Dharma, because you develop beautiful qualities that help you look honestly at yourself, honesty being one of them, integrity, humility. So those, there are character develop, and that helps, metta helps in character develop, so you're not wasting anything. But at some point, the tension that you are applying, it just is not satisfactory. You know, and that, and also the metta doesn't last. You know, and the next time it comes up, there it is again. And so, like, you've used this patch. You know, this is. And so, anyway, so in your own time, okay? So just let it play itself out, and you just stay vigilant in its value and its limitation. Last question.
I'm noticing that when I'm avoiding things, there's fear behind it. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Remember when she says when she's noticing things, there's fear behind it. Remember that when I talked about guarded and unguarded. Okay. So fear is an expression of guardedness. Right. So if you do something to that fear, you're guarding yourself against the fear, right? No matter what you do, you're going to be guarding yourself in trying to diminish, make this thing disappear. The only thing you can do that doesn't do that, that deconstructs rather than constructs, is to see fear. Not see in terror, that's just adding more, but just see it. Now you got to play games with yourself to get your courage up to be able to do that, you know. So there are, I'll give other talks on fear. But, you know, fear has its own language, it has its own feeling. And so it may be that I want to be with the bodily sensations of fear rather than the state of mind of fear. There's different things. It's always in the future, it's never in the present. Fear says, if you keep doing this, this is what's going to eventually happen. It's not happening now. So if you stay present, seeing keeps you present to the now in which the object of fear is not being met. If you lose yourself in what the thinking tells you is going to happen, then that's where fear has its control and its power. Because it says that rope, you know, is a snake really. It's not a rope, it's a snake. Oh my God, it's a snake. Well, the snake is, okay, so the snake is, it's a snake, so it's a snake. It hasn't bitten me, and that's what I'm afraid of, right? So now I'm afraid it's going to bite me, and it comes and it bites me. Now I'm not afraid of it biting me, it's bitten me. I'm afraid of dying. So now I'm afraid of, I haven't died. You see how it just keeps, it just puts the next step. Now I'm dying. Well, now I'm dying, I'm dying. Oh, I'm not afraid of dying, I'm afraid of going to hell. Right? So I can work this thing, you know, I just... Okay, all, thank you for your attention.